When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A 1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. Welcome to Insights, everyone. Today, we're excited to have Ryan Dusick on the show. Ryan's the former drummer and was a founding member of the band Maroon 5, one of the most popular groups in the world. Dusick was even part of the band that preceded Maroon 5, Kara's Flowers, which he and Adam Levine, Jesse Carmichael, and Mickey Madden founded in 1994, while they were still in high school. Today, Ryan's an associate marriage and family therapist, a mental health professional focusing on anxiety and sobriety. He's also a published author with a new book out now titled Harder to Breathe, a memoir of making Maroon 5, losing it all, and finding recovery. Ryan works at the Missing Piece Center for Anxiety in Agoura Hills, California, where he's spreading the message that recovery is possible. We're thrilled to have him on the show today, and we hope his message has a positive impact on each of you who are listening. From Diddy TV, here's Amy Wright with Ryan Dusick on Insights.
Let's talk about your book, Harder to Breathe, but before we get there, I just wanted to kind of go back and let's talk a little bit about the starting of Maroon 5 and the band, because that kind of leads into the book and what you experienced and where you are today and all that kind of fun stuff. So where did you grow up, Ryan?
I grew up in LA, Los Angeles, California, pretty much right in the middle of the city in a little neighborhood called Carthay Circle. But I've lived all over the city, and I've lived in LA my whole life, with the exception of the touring and traveling that I've done. LA. Yeah. I mean, we started the band at Brentwood High School, which was a kind of a, rich preppy college prep school, which I didn't really feel like I fit in at all personally. My family did fine, but these were the uber affluent kids, of Brentwood and the Valley and the Palisades and stuff like that, Malibu. But there were four guys there that played music, and we were all on the same page and kind of a group of misfits. I've known Adam since I was a little kid. We were like family, not family friends, but, friends of friends. And so I had started a band with him when I first started playing the drums when I was like 12 years old, and we were really silly. But a few years down the line, we were both at Brentwood, and that's when we really hit it off, and he was friends with Jesse and Mickey. And there was just a natural chemistry between the four of us. I was two grades ahead of the rest of them, and I had played in bands, in the school band and my older brother's band, for a couple of years there. So I had a little more experience, and they were just getting started, playing at the homecoming dance and stuff like that.
So I'm wondering what a 12-year-old plays when you play together. 12. What exactly did you actually play?
Well, you have to imagine at 12, it was probably about 1989 for me. That was the era of Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue and a lot of other hair bands.
Of course.
Sunset Strip. And Adam and I started a band with a friend of ours, Adam Salzman, who was really into that stuff. Not that we weren't, but he was really into that stuff. But I think I learned how to twirl my sticks like Tommy Lee, before I learned how to play a beat, probably.
It's important to look good while you play the drums, right? I mean,
oh, absolutely. Especially at that time. Very much so.
So when did you start playing drums? Were you a kid? Really little? Or was that more sort of around 12, 13 years old?
Yeah, I was a baseball guy when I was a kid. Music didn't really, I didn't get the music bug until my older brother started playing electric guitar when he was 14 and I was 10, 11. At 12, I begged my parents for a drum set, and they said, no, it's too loud. And then Christmas morning, I woke up and there was an old jazz kit in our
nice.
Living room. So obviously have to thank them for that. And I, you know, I just dove into it head first at that point. I was really inspired. And my dad tells a funny story because my brother like learned to play guitar really fast. He was a lead guitarist in a band within like 6 weeks of starting to play, just practicing, staying up all night. And when I was begging him, I said to him, he says that I was crying. I don't remember crying, but he says I was crying to him. And I said, Dad, the drums are inside of me in the same way that they were inside of Josh. The guitar was inside of Josh. The drums are inside of me, just waiting to come out. So he couldn't say no to that. Maybe that was just me being smart.
I was going to say, that's a pretty impassioned play for a kid. Yeah. So as a parent, I'm sure you had to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Well, so you played baseball and now you're playing music. Was there ever a time where you're thinking, which way do I go? Do I go music? Do I go baseball?
No, it was kind of just, I kind of switched over. I had problems pitching. I had arm injuries pitching. I had been a really good pitcher in Little League and up into high school. And at age 14, 15, I was having arm problems. And at the same time, that was when the music was becoming more serious for me and just, you know, started playing in my brother's band at that time and playing at the Whiskey and the Roxy and the Troubadour, you know, the main clubs in Hollywood, all age clubs. And so it was, I think, I guess after 10th grade, it was either play summer league baseball and continue to frustrate myself with the pitching injuries I was having. Or go out and play more gigs. And I chose the rock life, which is kind of weird that, you know, the arm injuries didn't really bother me playing the drums at that time. I couldn't pitch the way I wanted to, but drums, I felt great. It just seemed natural. It seemed like where my passion was and where my body wanted to be at that point.
Did you ever play the belly up? I'm wearing the belly up t-shirt.
The belly up, that's down south, right?
Yeah, San Diego area, yeah. Kind of a big venue that a lot of guys go through, play there. Seems like it would have been on your list.
Yeah, I think in the Maroon 5 Songs About Jane days, we played there 3-4 times, opening once for Nika Costa, which was a fun tour, and then opening for Carl Denson's Tiny Universe. I have a memory for these things. The other guys don't know. But then we ended up headlining there, I think, when we had our first headlining tour.
So before Maroon 5, you guys started another band, right? And you even got signed to a label at that point. So what was the name of that band?
Yeah, Kara's Flowers was the name of the band originally. We started the band in 94. So we were actually a band for 8 years before Songs About Jane. And we had a record deal as Kara's Flowers. A lot of people mispronounce it as Kara's Flowers, which always used to aggravate us. And part of the reason why we changed the name.
Was there an actual Kara?
There was a Kara. She was a girl that went to Brentwood with us. And I had a crush on her. And so there was a whole story there that's in my book, Harder to Breathe, which it was, we started the band the night that was Kara's birthday. And Adam, being the adventurous spirit that he is, he recommended that we go sneak out of my parents' house and go deliver flowers. Well, the idea wasn't originally to deliver flowers. It was just to go wake her up and annoy her, I guess, in the middle of the night. It ended up being this long journey, and we ended up picking up flowers on the street along the way and getting to her house at like 4 or 5 in the morning. So, and then that was the night that we like wrote our first songs, and we like had this epic bond over this adventure we took. So that was how we became Kara's Flowers. And yeah, we got signed right out of high school to Reprise, Warner Brothers, and made a record that everyone was, you know, promising was going to be as big as the Beatles. And it sold about 2,000 copies.
So what did you learn from that experience that you guys applied to later? Because obviously, when you put out your first Maroon 5 album, it was a whole different ball game, and that was a meteoric rise. So you must have learned something from the first experience.
Yeah, we learned a lot from that experience. Some great things and some things not to do, you know. that was like a crash course. I kind of look at it as like that was going to high school or going to college for the music industry before we actually, you know, made it. But I guess what we learned more than anything was that nothing is a sure bet. You know, there's we signed with a major record label. We had the top, you know, managers and agents and attorneys and everything. And it was one of those deals that they don't make anymore, I don't think. You know, it was the 90s, and it was they were promised to spend $1 million on us, and you know, everything was high class. We were in a top-notch studio with a top-notch producer and all that stuff. So it seemed like just inevitable that that would lead to, you know, success on a global scale. I think more than anything, what we learned is that nothing takes the place of good old-fashioned hard work and, you know, doing it in the grassroots kind of way, which is what we ended up doing on the Songs About Jane. Because with that record, it was really just kind of put it out, see if it sticks, throw a bunch of money at it. If there was more of a marketing campaign than that, we weren't aware of it. We didn't see it. That was the old world of the music business. They would sign 10 bands in a year, spend $1 million on each of them, and one of them would hit, and that would, you know, pay for everything when they had one massive multi-platinum record. We just didn't realize, we were pretty naive, you know, we didn't realize how the business worked. But the next time around, you know, we made Songs About Jane for like a quarter of the budget. We chose a record label that was an indie label. It was three guys. And so we knew we were going to get a lot of personal attention. The people that we signed on to represent us, our manager and our, attorney and stuff like that, were all people that were a little younger, a little hungrier, a little more, had something to prove, and were willing to do the work as much as we were. We were dedicated to going out on the road for however long it took and building up a fan base in, you know, the old fashioned grassroots way. So we learned, you know, the work ethic and the sort of, that if you want to make it, there's really no shortcuts.
Well, did you, you all went to college. Was it, were you all in the same college, or did you kind of disperse at that point?
Well, I was, I think, the only one that finished college. I went to UCLA. Adam and Jesse took a semester at a college in New York called Five Towns College. It was a music school, I think. That was just at a moment in the band's life when we were at a sort of a crisis. We didn't know which way we were going. The first album had failed, and we were already kind of past it in terms of style. We were trying a lot of different new genres, you know, and it was a little confusing. We were all kind of on different pages. And Adam and Jesse, I think, were getting frustrated with me and Mickey just in terms of not being on the same page and them wanting to control the direction, I think, in terms of style more and as the main songwriters. And they just, I think we needed a minute to kind of take a step back and see where we were at. So they went for a semester to New York. Mickey and I both went to UCLA, back to UCLA for me, Mickey for the first time. He was in the theater program. I was in the English program. And then Adam and Jesse came back after that semester and we reunited. And all of a sudden we had a new direction and a sort of a rejuvenated bond between the four of us. And we were more on the same page in terms of what we were trying to do musically. And as fate would have it, fortunate for me, in the 3 years between there, you know, when we got back together and when the next record deal came, I was able to finish my degree at UCLA and get a bachelor's in English. So that all worked out pretty well for me.
I was going to say, so you had that kind of going for you at that point. You could just focus on the music. And so how did you all get on the same page musically? Because that's not always the easiest thing. And, you know, you have to kind of all be in that same headspace when it in terms of the genre or the type of music that you're going to put out. So how did you guys do that?
Yeah, I don't know if it was fate or divine intervention or what, because we were pretty scattered and all over the place. I mean, if you listen to demos around 98 99, every single one sounds different, like we're a totally different band. We're just trying out a lot of different styles. But when Adam and Jesse went to New York, for whatever reason, the music that they were listening to was like the same music that I was listening to back home. And it was stuff that we hadn't really been inspired by before as a band. It was stuff from our youth, like Michael Jackson and Prince, but then it was also like Stevie Wonder was a major influence, and other, you know, classic soul, Marvin Gaye, Sam Cooke, that kind of stuff, and funkier groove based hip hop and R&B. Adam was really into the Lauryn Hill record. I was really into the D'Angelo record, which he was really into as well. So we, strangely enough, they came home and we were like all of a sudden on the same page again, and doing our best impression of kind of more beat driven, groove based music. And it just kind of clicked. We all were like inspired again and really kind of pushing each other to try new things.
So you put out Songs About Jane, and it starts off on kind of a slow build, and over a few years, and eventually went quadruple multi-platinum, I think. Yeah. It was a huge album for you guys. Were you put it out? Were you touring around the world? What were you guys doing?
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, the plan was to really go out there and do it grassroots, and the label was dedicated to keeping us on the road and really just building up a fan base. So we knew off the bat that the record was not going to be coming out for a while, that we weren't going to have a hit for at least a year, because this wasn't going to be one of those one and done, you know, radio plays kind of things. Because strangely enough, as much as it now seems like a pop record, at the time, the industry didn't know what to do with it, because they thought every label passed on us, like saying that it was neither rock nor R&B nor pop. It was kind of in between all of those things, and they were all suggesting we, you know, pick a lane. And we said no, we want to be unique. The fact that we're a little bit of all those things, I think, makes us have more, you know, we stand out a little bit more and maybe have some more staying power. So we went on the road at the start of 2002. The record didn't come out until the summer of 2002. The first week it sold like 2,000 or 3,000 copies, maybe 5,000 copies. And then it went down, and then it just slowly picked up like 100 copies a week. Like wherever we went, you know, on tour, opening for other artists and stuff, we would sell another 50 copies there. And then, you know, the next week, another 100 copies and somewhere else. And so we could see it like week by week that it was just, you know, gathering a little bit of steam each month. And then Harder to Breathe, they took to radio as the first single, very wisely, as a kind of more modern rock sound. And they literally just went like old fashioned, going into every radio station one by one. We walked in with our acoustic guitars and, you know, tried to charm the pants off of every radio programmer in the country. And over a matter of like 6 months, we finally had, you know, a moderate radio hit and a gold record, and did our first headlining tour in the fall of 2003. And so we were literally 2 years into touring on Songs About Jane when This Love came out as a single, and it came out internationally, and then it really started to blow up. And so, yeah, the overnight success that took a decade.
Yeah, that's the hard work that you were talking about. It is hard work. And, you know, I was wondering if you could really do that today, because the whole corporate radio, you know, it's become so corporate that going to radio stations and saying, here, play this, you know, a lot of the DJs don't even have that latitude anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said that I know exactly how the industry works in that regard now. But yes, it does seem like it's a very different world. Of course... our label's approach was not the norm at that time either. Things were going more online at that point, becoming more corporate. And, you know, when I say the old-fashioned way, I'm talking about the 1950s, you know, when you would just get in a truck and head down to the South and walk into a radio station and give them the 45 or whatever and say, play this record. People weren't doing that in the 80s and 90s either. You know, it was much more of a big money kind of corporate adventure in those days. So, but that's what we liked about it. We thought, you know, this is a much more, tangible way of day by day earning what you what you get.
So who were you opening for? And was that really helpful as well, depending on who the particular band was or artist was?
Yeah, we were really fortunate to open for some great artists and artists that I think their audiences were well suited to what we were doing and diverse in terms of the different kinds of audiences we were playing for. The first couple tours we did, I mentioned Nika Costa. That was, I think, the second tour we did. The first one was Michelle Branch, who had a big hit at the time. So there was the kind of the pop audience. And then Nika Costa had kind of a little bit more of a soul, more diverse audience. And after that, let's see. There were a bunch of tours. In the summer, we did an outdoor festival with on the main stage was Sheryl Crow and Train and Ziggy Marley. And then we were on the second stage with a bunch of other newer acts. And we started that tour on opening the second stage. And by the end of the tour, we were headlining the second stage, I think. So that was kind of how that went. But at the end of that first year is when we started getting real big headlining opening gigs for, we opened for John Mayer, in the fall or winter of that year. And then in 2003, Matchbox 20, John Mayer was a real big, proponent of, giving us kind of a lot of exposure. He was a friend of James from, the Berklee School of Music. They did a summer semester there, I think. And so when the timing was right, we approached him and he was all excited. He loved the record. And so he was really, really kind and gracious to give us some opening spots. And that turned into, in 2003, we did a whole tour with him. We did a tour with Counting Crows. Before we even headlined, we were playing arenas and amphitheaters with some major acts that, were pop and rock and soul and stuff like that. So very cool.
Any advice these guys were giving you along the way?
Well, yeah, we heard the same advice over and over again, which was on your first album, say yes to everything, because when you say yes to the concert promoters and the radio stations and whoever else is asking things of you, they're going to see that you really worked hard. And when you come back around, they're going to want to work for you. But if you say no, they're not going to ask again. Right.
Right.
So we heard that story from actually U2 we ran into at the Top of the Pops in London at the BBC, and Bono and Edge were in the dressing room next to us. They were playing on the roof that night, and they said that. I mean, we were 2 years into it at that point, so we obviously had already adopted that advice, but it was still good advice. I don't know if it's great advice from a mental health perspective, because saying yes to everything is not great boundaries and you can burn yourself out. But it was certainly in terms of making friends in the industry and knowing that you can set up a career that's going to be, have legs.
So how were you guys dealing with the fame? Because that was a really fast rise to fame and I'm sure there was a lot of fun parts of it. Were there any challenges to it, or was it just a fun ride at that point?
There were a lot of challenges to it for me in particular. I think for all of us at different points, I mean, you can imagine being on the road for 4 years straight. And it was a slow climb, but we were literally, you have to be on pretty much 24/7. There's not a lot of downtime in that, especially on that first album, when you're saying yes to everything. It's like you wake up in the morning and you have to click on, and whether it's being on stage or being in a radio station or doing a video shoot or a photo shoot or doing a meet and greet with fans or industry, or there's always something that you have to show up and be on for, which for some people is probably wonderful. I'm a bit of an introvert more by nature. I like being social, but there's a limit to it. I need my time to kind of recuperate and settle down. So there was none of that. And that definitely took its toll on me. I'm also kind of a perfectionist, and by nature, I was kind of a high-strung, anxious person. And performing night after night, and being in that position, even though I didn't experience it really as stage fright. I was excited to perform, but it was just a lot of energy, a lot of adrenaline, a lot of excitement that turned into anxiety at a certain point for me that definitely took its toll. I know that the other guys felt the challenges of that at different times in different ways as well, which I touch on a little bit in the book. For Adam, I think that, you know, just singing, he was not a trained singer and I was not a trained drummer. He had to learn how to adapt to performing every night and how to really sell it. I think that he had to kind of step into a whole other persona of a front man, which he hadn't fully done before, I think, that time in the band's life, realizing that a lot was on his shoulders in terms of delivering a great show and everything and being the charismatic front man that we needed him to be. And he really did step up. But I think that at a certain point, it was a real challenge for him, feeling that pressure as well.
You know, I hadn't really thought about it, but I read this book one time and they were talking about the difference between introverts and extroverts. And they said the difference is an introvert needs downtime to recharge and an extrovert actually recharges through social contact. And yeah. So it's two very different people. And, you know, you're in a situation like you guys are in where you're touring. You don't have a choice. Whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, you're going to have to be out there day after day after day performing. And like you were saying, you're a perfectionist on top of it. So there's no way for anyone really to perform at their top level every single day. So there's going to be days that you probably feel like, hey, I could have done better with that performance or something like that. And that can kind of weigh on you as well, I would think.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that my gauge as to how good a show was a little off because I was so consumed with how well I was doing. You know, because I put so much pressure on myself to be, yeah, to be perfect, that I was worrying mostly about, you know, did I do every fill in the set properly? Did I hold a steady beat throughout the whole set? That, you know, did everything go exactly as I imagined it in my mind? And if there were one or two or three or four moments in the set that didn't meet that standard, it was a terrible set, you know? And then sometimes I would walk off stage and I'd be like, oh, that was so bad. And Adam would be like, wow, the energy was so great. The crowd was crazy. Did you see that? And I really didn't notice because I was so consumed with how I was doing. And then there were other times when I was like, that was perfect. Oh my God, I nailed that. Everything from the first count in to the last beat was like perfect. I did everything exactly the way I wanted to. And he was like, there was no energy. It was dead. Like that show had, I don't know what was up with the crowd or whatever. He was out front, of course. He could feel the energy of the crowd more. And he was more concerned, obviously, with how it was going over to them. He could be hard on himself too, though. He was definitely a victim of the same kind of, I think, perfectionism and wanting everything to go exactly as he imagined it to be. He definitely has that element of his personality too. So I think we relate.
Yeah. So at some point, your injury started kind of resurfacing. The injury you talked about earlier. Maybe it was from baseball, but you said that initially drums didn't do that to you, but at some point that starts to come back. And when was that?
Yeah, looking back on it now, I mean, it was a very physical injury at the time. And with the benefit of hindsight, I'm able to see that there was also a mental health element to it, if not a major part of it. The psychology of it was definitely a big factor. The pitching injury came back. My right shoulder definitely started hurting. I started having a lot of inflammation in my right shoulder. In the middle of our first headlining tour, I think, when we jumped up to playing long sets and traveling a lot, and then we started going overseas. I always had an issue with jet lag and sleep. Sleep was a problem for me in general, but on tour in particular. And so when I was jet lagged, it was like, there were times when it was like 48 hours without sleep and having to perform and that kind of thing. And so it was taking its toll on my body, but also just on my general constitution. I knew that I had this joint issue and I started kind of contorting my mechanics, which were already flawed because I was not a trained musician. I was self-taught. But if I look at the early videos of me, my mechanics were actually not too bad. They were pretty fluid. It was just that my sticking technique was not really there. But my already flawed mechanics became worse when I was playing through pain and when I was playing through exhaustion. And it became confounding because it went from joint pain, a lot of discomfort, to nerve issues, not being able to coordinate things the way that I used to. And so, I mean, I had a legitimate nerve problem that made drumming difficult. But I realized now that a part of that was that my body was just telling me that I needed to stop because I was driving myself into the ground. And there really was no way to stop at that point, short of just quitting, I don't think. And it's, you know, essentially what ended up happening. But I look back at it now as kind of traumatic. I had a hard time looking at it as trauma for a long time because I reserved that word for, you know, horrific things that people live through that I didn't think this compared to, because there were no, you know, bullets whizzing by my head, and this wasn't, you know, childhood physical trauma or anything like that. But trauma is relative, and my body and my mind, and as I said, my whole constitution was put through something that dragged on for a long time and took its toll on me. And every time I thought I would have a break, it's just the breaks evaporated. And more, I think my body just kind of said, you're done.
Well, it had to be really hard to go through the decision to leave the band at that point, because everything was going great with the band, right? And you're doing all the right things, and you're getting on the best tours, and it's just, everything is going gangbusters for you guys. And here you are in this position to make a decision to leave. So what was that process like for you, and how did you actually get to that point?
Well, it wasn't exactly my decision, but there was really no other decision to be made. I went down on tour a couple times and tried to come back. And I did successfully the first time. I took some time off and then came back, and we played for a while and had some of my best shows during that time, I think, even though, like I said, my mechanics were a little contorted, but it just kept rising up again, the problems. And eventually the band, you know, said, like, you need to go home. You need to do whatever you have to do to figure out what's wrong and to solve it. And they were really great about it, to be honest. I mean, we were brothers, you know, since we were teenagers and in this thing together. And they were very supportive. They, of course, couldn't have understood what was going on for me, because I couldn't even understand what was going on for me. But they were basically like, go home. If it takes 6 months, if it takes a year, just get well, and we'll be here when you get back. How many bands would say that, right? I mean, that's pretty sweet of them. So I did that. But what happened was it just got more and more frustrating. Like, nobody could give me really a straight answer as to what the problem was. I felt really defeated, and it dragged on for like a year and a half of me just trying to figure out how to overcome this thing, and it wasn't really happening. And the band, you know, the whole album cycle ended at that point, and the band was working on new material for a follow-up album, which was already 4 years and then 5 years, you know, down the line from Songs About Jane. So it just came to the point where it was like, we need to move ahead. And Adam said to me, you know, even if you could come back and play the drums on this record, I'm really worried, you know, that you haven't solved what this is, so that we're going to have a major tour booked, international tour booked in support of the new album, and then you're going to go down again. So I understood that. It's easier for me to talk about now with maturity. I was in my 20s and in a lot of pain at the time, so it obviously was not something that I took well at that time. But they didn't have any other choice other than to move on at that point.
So that kind of brings me to Harder to Breathe, because, you know, you kind of discuss all of this in the book, but then there was a whole journey after that you had to get through as well. Like you're saying, you had to deal with all that trauma, because that is trauma, and that's a young age to go through something like that. It was a big cycle of, you know, start here, rise to fame, and now you actually have to leave the band. And so why Harder to Breathe? Why did you pick the name that, from that particular single? And what did that kind of mean to you? And how does it apply to the book?
The name Harder to Breathe has a lot of meaning in this context for me. I actually picked the name before I started writing the book, to be honest. I sat down, I was in grad school getting my master's degree in clinical psychology at Pepperdine University, and you have to do a lot of introspection to be a therapist. You know, you have to really figure out your own stuff, or at least you should. Some therapists maybe don't, but I was already in a really good place because I had been, I got sober in 2016.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And, you know, all of the ways in which I had struggled after leaving the band for a decade, really, was my whole life was turning around at that point. And that's why I had gone back to school and everything. So I had a new sense of purpose in my life. And writing the book for me was an extension of that journey. It was a way to tell my story in a way that hopefully could be helpful to some people. I knew that I had a story to tell, but then I realized when I was in grad school that it had a happy ending, and that it was a hopeful book. It wasn't just a sad, heartbreaking book. So I knew that it could be inspiring to people and that it could help some people. And Harder to Breathe, the title, first off, that song was a song that we, you know, I really killed myself over. We played that song, you know, on every TV show and every radio station across the country and world, over and over and over again. And it's kind of ironic that the refrain is it's getting harder and harder to breathe as, you know, my life on the road was getting more and more difficult for me. And it also goes back to just reflecting on the anxiety that kind of led to some of those problems. And that became a major problem for me after I left the band, because after I left the band, I was very depressed. I was drinking too much. And then anxiety disorder became a major issue for me. Panic disorder, even almost agoraphobia at the end. I couldn't really function out in the world. And so if anyone who's had a panic attack can relate to the term harder to breathe. So on a lot of levels, it just felt like, oh my God, this is the book I need to write, because it's not just about here's some fun stories about the band, which it has, but it's about my story of what I struggled with even before the band, certainly in the touring years, and then after, and what it took to overcome all that, what it took to get to a place of hopefulness and recovery. And here I am as a therapist and an advocate now, talking about this stuff, teaching people about this stuff, and it just felt like that was the only name that the book could have, Harder to Breathe.
So what led you to recovery? I mean, how did you start that process? And was there a moment when you said, I've got to do something here? Or was it a gradual process for you?
Well, it was gradual. But there was a moment, as most alcoholics will tell you, you know, a sort of moment of clarity. I did what every alcoholic does, which is try to find every rationalization and every way of sort of deluding myself that the drink was the answer to my problems, even when it was, the evidence was very clear that the opposite was true, you know. But I was really struggling. And on top of the alcoholism, I mean, underneath the alcoholism really, was a grieving process. You know, I had this wonderful experience starting the band, building the band up to where it became, and achieving what we finally did after a decade of work. And my identity was wrapped up in that. And my social circle was wrapped up in that. And my sense of self-definition and happiness and everything was wrapped up in that. So losing that and having to walk away from it just as it was reaching its apex was devastating, and a loss that, you know, you don't think you have to grieve things other than people that you lose in life, but losing that whole part of my life, that identity, was something I needed to grieve. And I think it was just, it took a decade really for me to get to a place where I hit rock bottom with the alcoholism. I hit rock bottom sort of spiritually, just feeling really disconnected from the world with all of my anxiety and everything and isolated. And it took a few humbling moments, as it does some people. Fortunately, it wasn't the kind of thing where I was on the street and begging, you know, for money or like anything really permanent to my health or otherwise. So I'm really fortunate in that regard that I kind of hit a spiritual bottom and not that kind of a bottom. But recovery started when I realized I just didn't want to live this way anymore. I was tired of feeling broken and feeling sick and so I went into rehab. I went to the Betty Ford Center out in the desert. And after I got past the initial phase of like detox and stuff, I started having what, you know, people refer to as a spiritual awakening, which always sounded cliche to me. I was like, what does that even mean? It's just kind of new age nonsense. But it's very tangible for me in that I was disconnected from the world and people and from living. And then all of a sudden I started feeling reconnected to people and the world and living. I started feeling a sense of purpose in being of service to people, to my fellows, showing up and being there for people, in telling my story, and realizing that I had some talents that I had forgotten about, you know, being a musician for so long. I was like, oh yeah, I used to be a pretty smart guy. I used to be pretty articulate before all this. And I have something else to offer other than being the drummer in Maroon 5. And that was the first time in a long time that I had that feeling. And so it was inspiring, you know, it's like, oh my God, I thought my life was just going to be like, you know, the rest of it is just going to be, oh, well, I had it good. And now I just kind of have to live the rest of my life now to, oh my God, I might have more good or even better to come. And so I was just, you know, really, really inspired by the spirit of recovery and wanted to give of what I was learning. And so I decided to become a therapist and write a book.
So how did you discover therapy as a profession? And obviously it's inspiring to you. And I think it's an amazing story in the book. But how did you make that decision and come to the conclusion that, hey, that's my new purpose?
Well, when I finished my initial sort of outpatient program in recovery, I was less than a year sober. The people that ran that place asked me to stay on as a volunteer and continue to work with some of the people there and lead some groups and just kind of be a peer support and co-leader of groups. And I thought that was really a cool thing. And I thought it would be great just for my sobriety. And so I did that for 2 years, just showed up there and I was in classes, I was in groups, and I just kind of gave people you know, the things that I'd learned and told them my experience. And I kept getting a lot of good feedback, you know, just people saying, you know, thank you so much for your help. And, you know, you have a great way of articulating the ideas of recovery. And, and that, you know, when I told my story, it was inspiring to them. So I was like, well, maybe there's something to this. And some people I knew were going back to school to get their master's degree. And people were telling me, you should consider doing this for a living. And my first response was like, well, I had never thought of that. But then now that you say it, it's like, it makes perfect sense. And so I just applied to a grad school. And within a month, I was in a clinical psychology master's program. And at first I thought I would just get my degree and become a therapist and go back to working in addiction recovery. But my whole world kind of opened up and I realized I don't really know where it's headed exactly, but I know that I have a passion for psychology and for helping people, hopefully. And so I had a new sort of lease on life and a new direction and purpose to become a therapist and just see, you know, what directions I could go in terms of being of service to people.
Well, and in Harder to Breathe, it's a story of the formation of a band. It's also the story of all that comes with that, and then the triumphs and the pitfalls, and then obviously coming back from all that, which is incredibly positive. So there is a band component to this, but there are life lessons in there, I think, for anyone who reads the book. And so what would you say is the the main takeaway that you want people to come away with reading from reading this book from your story?
Well, the main takeaway, when you finish the book, is that there is hope, even when it seems like there is no hope. There are second acts in life. You know, you don't have to be defined by the thing that was so tragic or traumatic. That's the large arc of the story to me. That was the purpose for writing it. However, I would also say it's inspiring in a whole other way. It's, you know, the whole journey of the band is just a lot of fun. It's really innocent in the early years, and then it becomes intense, obviously, as we become more more successful. And so that whole journey is inspiring in its own way, just seeing kids sort of dreaming big dreams and pursuing them and what hard work and dedication can get you. And just also reflecting back on what I learned later in my life, just how magical that was of a connection, you know, the spiritual connection between the four of us and then five of us. So I think hopefully it's inspiring in both of those ways, in terms of creativity, in terms of aspiring to do something great, and just enjoying the process, you know, the journey. But then also, you know, when bad things happen in your life, when things become really difficult and challenging for you, there's always hope. I'm just kind of living proof of that.
Well, Ryan, I'm so glad to meet you and hear that you're doing so well. It's a very inspiring story that I think a lot of people will read and apply to their own lives. So Harder to Breathe, go pick up a copy. But we really thank you for stopping by Diddy TV and visiting with us. Come see us in Memphis.
I would love to. This was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we hope you enjoyed hearing from Ryan Dusick on his new book, Harder to Breathe, a memoir of making Maroon 5, losing it all, and finding recovery. Thanks to Ryan for joining us on Insights to share his story. Hopefully it inspires those of you who are listening who needed to hear his message. We appreciate him giving us a behind-the-scenes look at his journey, and we look forward to seeing what he achieves in the years to come. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again soon. Right here on Insights.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.